Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Deep Water, a program on religion, culture, and public affairs. The theme of the program is that we, as faith communities, are only in our social ministries up to our ankles. We ought to be over our heads, hence the name Deep Water. My guests this afternoon are the Reverend Angela Ying of Bethany United Church of Christ on Beacon Hill in Seattle. Welcome back, Angela. How's the family?
It's good to be back. Thanks, Don.
Rabbi Jim Morrell of Temple B'nai Torah in Bellevue.
Always glad to be here with this group.
The Reverend Dr. Robert Jeffrey, Senior Minister at New Hope Missionary Baptist Church in Seattle. Robert, welcome back to you, too.
Glad to be back, Don.
Jeff Siddiqui, a member of the Greater Puget Sound Muslim Community. Welcome, Jeff.
Salam. Thank you very much.
And Sharon Moe, Senior Minister of University Temple Methodist Church here in the U District of Seattle.
Hi, Don.
My name's Don McKenzie. I'm Minister and Head of Staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. Last Monday evening, the President gave his annual State of the Union address, and our task today is to comment on that, both from a theological and political point of view, and see where those intersections are. And for myself, at least, I'm interested in the moral dimension of the address and the implications of that for life in this culture and the world. I'm going to ask Sharon Moe to start us off today.
Thank you, Don. Since we're going to be reflecting on President Bush's State of the Union address, I just want to outline first some of the issues which he addressed in that speech. Some of the broad strokes include the economy and the need for an economy that's growing. And he had a couple of proposals that deal with taxation, one about taxing dividends, and a second about continuing and making permanent the I'd like him to make it perfect, but at least making permanent the tax rebates that have happened the last couple of years. A second is health care and the need for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. And in that arena, the President talked about Medicare and legal suits against HMOs. Those were his two areas of discussion. He also talked about energy production and the need to care for the environment. A fourth issue that he dealt with was social issues that involve the needs of people, such as programs for drug-addicted populations, mentoring programs for people without children without mothers or fathers. And he also, I think one of his last one was to talk about some really controversial issues like the so-called partial birth abortion and cloning. And of course then he dealt with Iraq and his proposals for going to war with Iraq. Another issue that he dealt with was the need to provide drugs for people in Africa who are living with AIDS. So that's kind of the overview of what he dealt with in his speech. There were a number of points that I think are admirable that he made. For instance, the need for us to really respond to the crisis in Africa of AIDS, the pandemic around the world, but especially in Africa, and the needs for Medicare aid for senior citizens in this country, for pharmaceuticals. I think all of us would like to see those issues, those needs addressed. One of the real questions I have about his proposals is simply, where is all the money coming from? Because the proposals he's making are for large amounts of monies that are not incorporated in the current budget. We're looking at unfunded liabilities in the Social Security system, which are not evident in the budget that's being proposed. So I think his speech is, at the very least, exceptionally problematic. even though some of the things that he suggests are things that I would like to see happen.
So how do you get at the moral dimensions of what he's saying?
I think that the basic question for us, for all people, perhaps especially for the religious community, to ask is who is benefited by these proposals, by these moves? Who benefits? And I think that his proposals really deserve a deep look, a deep examination to try to get at an understanding of who's going to benefit from all of these proposals.
Okay, so let's take these. Let's look at the tax issue first. What he's trying to say, or at least what he seems to be saying on the surface, is that he wants us to believe that this tax proposal is going to benefit everybody. Is that true?
He does.
No, absolutely not. Well, you know, you look at the investment situation in this country. 1% of the people control most of the investments. 1% of the people control most of the investments in this country. And no, it's not going to 5% control the majority, 1% control most of it. And it's most 6% of the country that's going to benefit from this in any significant way.
So this is morally problematic, obviously, at least from my point of view as a religious leader. We have a statement suggesting this is going to help everybody, and it's really not going to help everybody.
Well,
it's going to help the rich.
If you feel that the stock market it helps everybody and that dividends ultimately would be reinvested, I think you can make a stretch. But, you know, that's the problem with this stuff. You know, you have to make the stretch, and you don't get... Once you make the stretch, it all depends on the goodwill of people who have demonstrated through the past that they have no goodwill for the poor.
Mm-hmm. I think the moral problem I have with with his speech and with his proposals was that in the name of patriotism, in the name of nationhood and nationality and God and fighting evil and all those fancy catchwords, he's throwing more and more money into the defense budget, into this so-called war against terrorism. He is giving more and more money to the people who already have a lot of money as tax breaks and tax relief. We have Bill Gates Sr. coming out and saying we don't want any more tax breaks, but no, the proposal is we will give you more money. And he's taking more and more away from the poor. At the same time, he's saying, I'm going to fund all these things on a budget that was barely making it before the tax rebate started going in, on a budget that was barely making it before the September 11 tragedy and the boost in defense expenses. So you shave off your budget and you promise more money. To me, that sounds like a house of cards or a pipe dream. And that is the immorality of it. There are going to be a lot of people who are going to have their hopes raised and pinned, and a lot of lives that are going to be shaken apart by this promise that was an empty promise to begin with.
So the hope, there may be a hope that this will benefit the entire culture, but as Robert suggests, that would only be true if you feel that the health of the stock market will benefit people in some sort of domino effect. But as he said, that's a stretch. The certainty, it seems to me, is that this will certainly benefit the rich.
That's absolute.
And at the same time, will take away from the poor. I mean, I think anything that benefits from the rich has to be seen as withdrawing support from the poor.
You know, I'd like to just follow up on that. You know, one of the things that I see, and I haven't been here in a while, and I don't want to dominate anything, but I just want to just react to that, is that it's this whole principle of, you know, almost like the elitist principle that somebody has to take care of everybody else because we can't take care of ourselves, and it's almost it's going down even in the African American community. You know, I've been doing a lot of thinking about this whole issue on racism and all this issue, affirmative action and all that. I think that what we're entering into this country is a period where we are putting emphasis on racial elitism. Even the president is talking about taking the top students out of inner city schools and making sure they have guaranteed right to go to college, which presupposes that these kids, if they are top students, that they probably come from good homes already, and many of them, majority of them. And you, what you're doing is shaving off this whole top perimeters of the minorities and running the country with that, which is a notion, the Republican notion, which basically is inherent in this country. It's not true democracy, but I don't think the country ever says it's true democracy. I think the problem is it was supposed to evolve into true democracy, and it didn't. And that's our problem, because you have an educated mass, whether they are educated from Harvard or Yale, they still have sense enough to know when they're being screwed. Mm-hmm. And that's not what the founding fathers ever imagined. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have that now. And this whole principle of that we should be satisfied because the top elite get integrated, like Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice, who are just as bigger jerks as the other top elite, who really don't care about poor either. So, I mean, that's what's going on in this country, and I think that that's, for me, a very fascist and dangerous notion.
So it's hard to believe that there is genuine concern for the impoverished in this culture coming from the president, given what we've just been saying.
Yeah. I think it's a concern. But I think it's a process that is antiquated and outdated, and that basically real democracy calls for a change in the way we deal with the problems of the poor. That we don't just shave off the top 10, even as many African Americans believe, and just give them money, give them opportunity, while the bottom 90% are left to languish in prisons and on our streets and crime. I think that that's a mistaken notion. It's a mistaken understanding of what democracy ought to be, and this country is bogged down in it, and now we've got a guy who wants to reinforce it, and the rule of the elite, and it's at a really tragic time, because this is a time when the bottom level are really, really not sleep.
He wants to reinforce and fund the rule of the elite.
Well, I think, in the comments that have been already shared, part of it is, if you see what's interwoven, is, again, is that of the poor. I mean, if you look at the war on Iraq, as we're going to discuss, this morning, and also, the taxes and the situation, it's like interwoven is that not only, I believe, everyone loses, not only as a country and as the world, except for those that are producing and causing profit, for themselves from the bombs that are sent over. But the poor, they always lose out. Inevitably, if you look at it, in peacetime, fathers, and sons are together. In wartime, fathers bury their sons, and we get people coming back in body bags. And what we see, with the tax, program, which again, others have shared before, that inevitably support the rich, is you get the people, not only the poor, but the working class, who are, as we've shared before, the majority of us, who are in a situation that are unable to come to the understanding of why, they're sending their children to kill other of the same, other children, and again, it's beyond race, but do you realize how, because of the neighborhoods or because of the economic injustice, that so many people of color and of different backgrounds are sent? It's not the people that are connected to the Bush family or whatever that are going to be in the front lines. It's the innocent, men and women who come from, families that are trying to make a difference and at the same time losing their lives. And then, when I think about it, as we were gathering, for the Martin Luther King Jr. rally, where hundreds of thousands of people came out, not only in Washington, D.C., but here in Seattle and even in Bellevue, they called it a war against the poor. And I think that was quite articulate to be able to connect the importance of, lifting up the issue of race as well as that of economic injustice. And to add that to a more personal piece, you know, when we're talking about taxes or, you know, how that affects the neighborhoods. I live in, and the church community that I serve is in Beacon Hill, and it's very close to the Central District and the International District and to, you know, all of South Seattle. And what one of the key pieces that we're finding out is they now want to put in that entire neighborhood the cell phone systems and towers all throughout the Central area, the International District, and Beacon Hill. And you think about it, they're always putting it in the property of the poor. They and we have children everywhere of diverse races and cultures that not only meet in the church but also, you know, have a daycare center right next to us that in which we house. And so, you know, we're not only talking about, you know, people that, you know, when we get into a bind, we're dividing people of different races and cultures, but also children that are being affected because, you know, again, you know, they don't think that they're impacting these neighborhoods, and yet they are so greatly.
Jim.
I'd like to turn our focus, you know, to the war in Iraq, because this is where I think a lot of the things focus on this coming war, mm-hmm. because the effects on the poor, lives that will be lost. And in a way, what disappointed me most about the speech is that it, like a lot of the State of the Union, it's just a shopping list of things that he wants to do. Mm-hmm. When we have this, you know, this overwhelming moral issue, mm-hmm. and if I were a president, I'd talk only about that, yeah. because this is something that affects the whole world, and when you make a shopping list of things I'm going to do, it just takes the attention away from that, he's saying, and it indicates that he just sees it as another part of his agenda, mm-hmm. which it isn't. It is a cataclysmic event that's going to change this world in a very, very negative way. So my criticism is that this is the way he approached the speech. Now, when he gets down to the end of the speech, he talks about the coming war, and he tries to justify it. And I think that to me is the most troubling part about it, because no one in the administration has made a cogent argument why we're sending thousands and thousands of people to the Persian Gulf, spending billions of dollars, mm-hmm. to undermine a regime that no one has indicated has in recent years done anything negative either to its own people or to the world. And this is really troubling to me. I don't think anybody would say that Saddam Hussein is a good guy. But going to war and putting that type of effort and losing potentially thousands of lives, Iraqi, American, mm-hmm. African, all the other soldiers are going to be there, and not to just say, I'm not going to talk about anything else but this, instead of just making a shopping list. Now, to me, we're on the verge of a war, and that should be our total focus of our country, and that's what people need to talk about now. Really, I would say talk about nothing else but that, because unless we can really speak up, if we have any kind of a democratic process, unless we can speak up now in a unified way and say, 60, 70, 80% of the people in this country oppose this war under the circumstances that it's being presented, mm-hmm. then I would say we are more at fault than he is at fault, because we may have some power. If we don't utilize that power, then we have to blame ourselves for not being absolutely clear. There is no argument. There is no cogent argument to go to war. Unless we say that over and over again in a variety of ways, then I put the fault on us as the citizens of this country for not making that clear. And I want to put my two cents in here now. I haven't heard nothing to justify going to war.
My struggle with this whole thing has been, first, I agree that this is one of the most earth-shattering things that's going to take place, probably in your and my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to change things, mm-hmm. Not for the good. Mm-hmm. My problem is with how we deal with that, how we vocalize our opposition to it. I think that this thing is being fueled, as I said before, by the notion, the, you know, so almost a runaway notion now, that that certain people can run the world better than others, and that basically they should take charge. And that's all over the world. It's being done in Israel. It's being done all over the world. And us going to war is just, with Iraq, is just getting those certain people together. It's interesting that Spain and Italy are being characterized as great nations. These are the nations that went with Hitler. These are the nations that joined the Hitler bandwagon early on. So, I mean, it's very strange to me that now these people who have always believed in elitist rule and who have always been fascists, and especially Spain. I mean, Spain has a reputation of being a fascist country under most of its leaders, even in modern history. And to say now that these are good people is to me very puzzling. And when the nation that gave birth to most of the democratic principles, France is basically, and France is no angel, but at least they are screaming against this stuff. I think that, and also that I think undergirding this stuff is I think tangible things that we can do something about. This is the rule of the elite is to me for the purpose of undergirding corporate expansionism. I mean, this is what this is all about. This is about money, and it's about greed.
And so doesn't it make you wonder, Robert, what Spain and Italy and the other so-called willing countries are getting out of this allegiance to President Bush?
It makes you wonder. But, I mean, when you look at the whole concept of corporate expansionism and greed and religion, Christianity, the whole concept of Christianity, when you look at all those ingredients put together, I mean, you can figure it out. I mean, it's not rocket science to figure out why these countries are lining up.
And, you know, if you think about it, you know, in like last week when we read, you know, about China and Germany and other countries that were not going to support Bush, you know, and that basically, you know, because I really believe, as Rabbi and Bob and others have said, that, you know, everyone loses, especially the poor, that beforehand these countries, you know, and a lot of the European allies were saying that they did not want him to go to war and they weren't going to support him and they wanted more time for the UN to do the inspections and everything, but he, with this State of the Union, which troubles me, not only came off as very slick, but part of it is, as we begin to see some of these people say, or some of these countries say, okay, we'll support them, what frightens me or terrifies me, because so many people in this country, I think, are opposed to the war, and many people, I'm sure, around the world, is that you have to ask, again, from the point of view, you know, what kind of concessions Bush is giving to these leaders in order for them to support him to go to a war, which, you know, basically there are no reasons, as we stated, to go to war and to kill innocent, you know, people in Iraq or in the Persian Gulf or even in this country.
So if we return to Sharon's initial question about who benefits, it seems that it's being suggested that it's really the same answer as the first issue, that is, it's the rich who will benefit from...
Certainly not the poor.
It's the corporations.
Their investors. I mean,
this is all coming on the heel of WTO. This is all coming on the heel of the anti-WTO movement. This is all coming on the heel of people trying to stop the unrestricted control of monopoly throughout the world of certain corporations. And all of a sudden now, our emphasis is not on that now. This is all coming on the heels of banking industry moving toward. It's also coming on the heels of the rise of Muslim banking industries throughout the Middle East, which is taking the place of American banking industries interests. I mean, this is about corporate control and greed. And the bottom line is that these are the same people we're feeding every day with our dollars. We're supporting these people, and that's the target. Not just marching in the streets saying we're against the war. We have to really go after those corporations who are selling arms and munitions to Iraq, chemical weapons, chemical material to Iraq, then turning around, getting this government to go to war against Iraq, and they're going to go back in and rebuild Iraq. I mean, this is just as insidious,
insane
evil. that these corporations have gotten so much power that they can push a government into that. Not just, it's, I think it's to, for me, it's not enough just to say the rule of the elite. It's the rule of the elite, but it's also being promoted by corporate power and corporate interests.
It's amazing in a complex situation like this how we've laid out quite a bit of detail about the moral problems with this war, and we haven't even reached the problem of violence itself. And so that gives us an idea, I think, of the magnitude of the moral issue in the possibility of war with Iraq.
And to add on to that, the moral issue that at stake, you know, in the address he brought about Africa and AIDS. But if you think about it, and I have spent time in Africa, and many of my colleagues understand the problem. And if you think about it, more than 90% of Africa was put under what you call SAPs, structural, you know, programs, structural agreement programs, where they had to say, okay, we will, you know, give up our land, you know, wonderful land filled with many, many, you know, minerals, you know, that could help the people, and we're only going to sell one particular product. And then after that, then the U.S. government or whoever was working with them ends up lowering the prices of that particular, you know, commodity so that the people can no longer live on the bananas or the tea or whatever that they were called to build anyway. So these structural programs, you know, put these African countries in huge debts, you know, while the U.S. and others continue to gain profit again for themselves. So it's a huge problem. It's not, the HIV is just one symptom of a poverty-stricken country who they're malnourished, they don't have enough water, you know, they don't have enough land, they were set up by these SAP programs, you know, in order, and then they're placed in a whole, you know, situation where, again, 90% of the people have no place to eat, sleep, you know, or have clean water in which to live. And that's all connected, again, back to our original, you know, understanding of why the poor lose out. Africa is an entire country, if not a continent, that reflects what happens when the people can't have their own, you know, independence and make their own stances of how they want to live, because they don't have clean water, they don't have good shelter, they don't have the money, and they were set up to be in these programs so that only, you know, those of the elite are always benefit from them, and they can no longer pay their debts, which they were set up to begin with. It was a lose-lose situation for that country.
The AIDS epidemic is, I think we would all agree, far worse than we can even imagine, with funerals in communities not just once a week but every day, and more than one on a day. Pastors running out of things to say. It's too horrible to imagine. And as Sharon suggested at the beginning, financial aid to that crisis is a good thing. But again, as she suggests, the question, who benefits from this? What do we say about that?
I think any time, someone earlier said, follow the money. You see where the money is going. Either the benefit either the aid guarantee to Africa for HIV, war against HIV, needs to be so substantial that people say, yes, it is a meaningful number. And with it, as it was pointed out, that with it must come the infrastructure support as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because AIDS is the whole meaning of AIDS is where your immune system is suppressed. If your immune system is suppressed, you better have good water so you're not attacked by other opportunistic diseases.
That's right.
Then you need to fight other diseases, the Zetse fly, the millions
malaria.
Of other diseases, malaria. These are things that are commonplace in developing world. But then to throw a what I would call a flashy bone in public, saying, look, aren't I a good boy? I'm doing this for the African nations. Now let's go fight Saddam.
Yeah, exactly.
And you follow the money. You follow it and see where it's going. The whole AIDS thing, I think the only lasting benefit will be to the pharmaceutical companies that are supplying what I call a pitifully undersupply of medicines under this program. Mm-hmm. 10 billion is nothing for all of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
We keep thinking of Africa as one tiny little state, maybe half the size of the state of Washington. It's a continent.
That's right.
With millions and millions and millions of people. Delivery systems aren't there, so even if you throw $10 billion, how are you going to deliver the medicine? So to me, it's a flashy bone being thrown as a palliative to the public opinion. The real motivation for this was attacking Iraq, and the real motivation behind that is money. The countries that are lined up to support the United States, they either want United States money that is being given to them now, mm-hmm. or like in Italy and France, they want part in the franchises that are going to come up in the oil and the rebuilding of Iraq.
So it's been suggested that often when a president begins a State of the Union address, he begins with the phrase, "The state of the nation is good." At least he didn't say that. What is the state of the nation? What's your judgment here? I mean, it sounds as if we're suggesting that the state of the nation is very bad.
I'd use the word precarious.
Okay.
I think it was precarious for me under Clinton. It's moved to extreme now, mm-hmm. and I think that's one of the problems with progressives being lazy and being satisfied with placating sort of empty policies that Clinton did for 8 years, and the country was making money, but he was placating. He was placating very dangerous people, and in the end, those dangerous people now run the country. And if we had taken those 8 years to really do our jobs and help create democracy in this country, I think those placating people could not have gotten to power. But they did, and they are. I think this is a very dangerous time for people of conscience and for people who understand the need for the rule of law and order in the world.
Well, that's our program for this time. Thanks to all our listeners. Join us again next month for another Step Down into Deep Water. This program was produced by Mike McCormick. Until next month, may God bless you and keep you.